Mother Knows Death presents External Exams with Nicole and Jemmy.
Hi, everyone. On this week's external exam, we will be talking about a topic that we don't hear much about, which is what happens when bodies go unclaimed. And as you guys know, that I have primarily done autopsies for my career, but when I was doing autopsies, I did have a position at the hospital where I was taking care of all of the dead bodies in the hospital, not just the ones getting autopsied. And there would be times, because I released the bodies to the funeral directors, there would be times that nobody picked a body up. And it was the rule in the hospital that when we had a body for longer than 7 days living in our morgue refrigerator, we would say, we would send the body to the medical examiner's office, and then they kind of had to deal with it from there, because in the hospital, we can't have people that are decomposing. Even though refrigeration slows down the rate of decomposition, we just couldn't have that because of the smell that happens, unfortunately. And we also just didn't have the resources to try to track down someone to come claim the body. So it definitely did happen throughout the course of my career several times. And we are going to be talking to two authors today of a new book that actually comes out today called Unclaimed: Abandonment and Hope in the City of Angels. And the authors are Pamela Prickett and Stefan Timmermans. So we're going to talk to them today. Welcome to the show, guys.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here. Pamela, we'll get started with you first. I know that you are an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Amsterdam, a writer and a former broadcaster. So can you give us a little bit information on your background and how you got interested in the topic of unclaimed bodies?
Yeah, well, thank you for having us on today. It's an exciting day for us, as you can imagine. So, yeah, I think I probably, like a lot of listeners and a lot of Americans, I didn't think about this subject. It's not one that had crossed my mind ever until I knew somebody who was at risk of going unclaimed. So I did my PhD research in Los Angeles at a mosque in South Los Angeles. And this was while I was doing my PhD at UCLA. And in the course of being at that mosque, there was one of the longtime members. I call her Sister Sherry. And Sister Sherry had been a member of this community for decades. She had a lot of insecurities in terms of housing. She struggled with drug and alcohol addictions. And she really relied on the mosque community to help her survive. She passed away. And I recall sitting in the back of the prayer hall one night during Ramadan when the head imam got up and he really implored the community that they needed to raise funds in order to go to court to claim Sister Sherry's body to help her avoid cremation, which is what the County of Los Angeles does in cases of indigent unclaimed deaths. And so it got me thinking about this question that I had never considered before. What happens if you die with no family willing to claim you? And in this case, would also be no religious community if we're talking about something outside of the mosque. And so I should say Sister Sherry was estranged from her family of origin. And that's how I came into the subject. And then I started Googling, as I think most people would, came across a couple of news stories in the Los Angeles Times. And I was just really surprised to find that every year in Los Angeles, around 1,500, and now the number has gone up closer to 2,000 people, are dying and being cremated by the county and their ashes interred in a mass grave in Boyle Heights. And it was something that I had never considered until I had encountered it personally.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I never really thought about the religious aspect of it too, because I guess their particular religion has rules what should happen after you die, and cremation isn't one. I don't really know their specific rules, but I do know that is with some religions. So that's interesting, because you definitely want to give people what they want to do with their body after they die. Stefan, you now have kind of some experience with dead bodies. You wrote a book years ago, which I actually have as well. So I was kind of excited to finally meet you, which is called Postmortem: How Medical Examiners Explain Suspicious Death. And I know when you wrote that book, you got to hang out at the medical examiner's office for a significant amount of time, which was probably a really cool experience for you, considering that you're a professor of sociology and that's not you're exactly what you went to school for. So I've had lots of people come observe autopsies and just look like very like a ghost, like they're about to faint. It's very traumatizing for them for the first time. But was this experience how you got interested in the unclaimed bodies?
Yes, it's sort of a bit of an extension from that project into the unclaimed bodies. I'm very interested in how we as a society deal with deaths that don't follow the script of good dying, where you're surrounded by family, you say goodbye, you focus on pain and comfort. And we have a very strong normative idea about what a good death should be. And so I'm interested in the deaths that fall outside that spectrum. Deaths that happen suddenly, unexpectedly, violently, or in the case of the unclaimed bodies, deaths where relatives are unable or unwilling to organize a funeral or organize a burial. And so I'm really interested in how do we fold these deaths into an understanding of this is salvageable. There's something. I mean, you cannot just leave these dead, but these unclaimed bodies laying on the street or leaving them in apartments. Something needs to happen with it, with these bodies. And so I'm interested in the professionals who deal with the unclaimed deaths, the sudden deaths, the suspicious deaths, the violent deaths, and how they then provide information to public health, to law enforcement, and to families.
So you're at UCLA and you're at University of Amsterdam. How did you guys meet?
Well, we met while I was at UCLA getting my PhD in sociology. And so I have known Stefan, my goodness, it's 15 or 16 years at this point. And so then when I approached him a little over 8 years ago, he thought he had gotten rid of me. And then lo and behold, I said, wait a minute, I got this idea. You want to come join me?
It's like a boomerang. She came back.
Yeah.
Send her away and then she comes back and here we are.
So did you decide to approach him with this particular subject because you knew that this was work he's done in the past and he was very familiar with the subject?
Absolutely. I knew after reading those LA Times articles and just sort of thinking about this that it was going to require going into the medical examiner, coroner's office, and dealing with government bureaucracies around death. And I knew the only sociologist who happened to write on that subject. So it seemed like a kind of obvious no-brainer as a collaboration. I'm not sure that I could speak that it was that much of a no-brainer for Stefan, but it was for me.
This is cool. So you guys, I know that in the book you follow four individuals that went unclaimed. And obviously you kind of had to go backwards because you didn't know them when they were alive. So I'm curious how that process went. How did you pick these specific four people? And then how did you, because your book took almost 8 years to research, correct? Like what was the process of not only finding these people, but then backtracking their life?
Stefan, do you want to take this one?
So this is where we're complementary. So I have a lot of experience with medical examiners and bureaucracies. But Pamela is really good at cold calling. So she can. So once we had a name of somebody, we had to, I mean, so we're dealing with it from a research perspective or from a reporting perspective. This is not an easy project because we're dealing with people, relatives who have said, no, we don't want to organize a funeral. So are they willing to talk to us? But what Pamela's strength is like she's really good at cold calling. So we have a name and we go to a neighborhood in suburbia in Los Angeles and she goes door by door or talking to the neighbors while I'm like in the car slinking away because I don't want to deal. I'm sort of like, oh no, what if they open the door? Because of course that's what we want. And so that's where we are very complementary. Pamela has no problem doing that and I have no problem sitting down with a pathologist or talking to the scene investigator, which by the way, in my book, people who work in the medical examiner's office, they're heroes. You know, every time you read something in a newspaper about a shooting or something, somebody has to deal with the body, and it's them who have to deal with the body. So they're really doing extraordinary, important work. And we have a tremendous admiration for the difficulty of their job, and but also for the professionalism that they bring to their work. You know, this is not one we set out to do in this book, but it's one of the things you came extraordinarily impressed with, the work that scene investigators and pathologists do.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, because it is really hard. I interned there for months while I was in PA school, and it's hard to see people die at the hands of another, especially, but yeah, just in general, all of these people that are there, like at the hospital, it's different because a lot of people were sick and they kind of knew that it was coming, maybe. But these are people in car accidents, people that were murdered, little kids. It takes an emotional toll on you, and people don't realize that.
No, and there's just no good stories. Anybody who ends up in the medical examiner's office, something went really badly wrong. And it's often the worst tragedy that you can imagine as a parent, as a sibling, as just in general. And so they deal with this, and it's relentless. It's just, you know, it's every day brings new of challenges like this. So we have tremendous admiration for the difficulty of that job and the care that they bring to the death investigation process.
So you actually went to people. See, I would be with you, Stefan, like in the corner hiding, because I wouldn't want to do that either. But that's cool that you felt comfortable enough to not only to talk to just strangers and just knock on their door, but I would be kind of scared that they'd be like, that bitch, I hate her. Like, I don't want to talk about her anymore or something like that. So it's cool that you had the guts to do that, because how the book came together.
We got that reaction too. I mean, we got the whole range of
reactions. I know. No. Some people in my life say
that.
Oh,
no, I thought you were talking about the decedent. Like, we don't want to talk to the decedent.
No, I'm just saying, like, if they didn't want to pick their body up and stuff, it could be because they had bad blood with them before they died, and they would be mad that you were even wanting to talk about it with them.
Yeah, no, and then
that's,
we got that.
Definitely.
We got that. We got somebody venting for more than an hour about how bad the decedent was.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you do think about that, because I don't have too much experience with death in my personal life, but you know, my grandparents and one of my uncles, there's lines at the funeral home for them to visit their bodies. And I've heard stories from funeral directors too, that even if someone does claim the body and get them a funeral, that nobody shows up. Yeah. And it's just crazy that all of us could really end up in that situation, which does bring me to my next question of how you've said in the book that it could go across all socioeconomic ranges, and it could be wealthy to poor, it could be any way, famous, not famous. What do you think is the main factor that causes bodies to be unclaimed? Is it financial, or is it more interpersonal relationships?
So, you know, there's a number of factors. It isn't one thing that we can point to. However, you know, cost is a considerable factor here. You know, the average funeral in the United States is over $8,000. That's not an insignificant amount of money, right?
I also think that figure is extremely low. I was thinking more like $20,000, to be honest with you. Like,
yeah, I mean, that could probably, you know, you would, of course, you know, this being an average, I can imagine on the coasts, it would be a lot more expensive. We know in Los Angeles, it's more expensive than that. But, you know, you can also find low-cost cremations. You can put together burial packages of your own rather than picking one of a private funeral home, a flat package. So you can sort of put things together. There's ways that people can get creative, although, you know, any amount of money, if you haven't been saving for this and a sudden death occurs, is going to be an unexpected expense. So financial considerations are absolutely important. That said, what I would probably tell folks is that more often than not, the County of Los Angeles in the cases that we observed, found next of kin, they located a legal next of kin, and those relatives chose not to claim, often because the ties had already withered. Maybe years ago, decades ago, we found widespread and extreme estrangement among family members throughout the county, right? And throughout different economic strata. Stefan, did you want to add more?
No, you did a great job.
So cost, family estrangement. And one thing I do also want to say, if I think back to the example, right, that I told you of how I came into the story and thinking about the mosque community and how they rallied together in order to prevent Sister Sherry from going unclaimed, there are also a lot of situations in which we're not living or necessarily close to our legal next of kin. That might not be how we've arranged our lives, right? We have these chosen families, we have close friendships. And what we were, I'll admit, a little bit surprised, I was surprised when I was in the coroner's office and observing the county to find that those people are not included. They're not allowed to claim. Now, you can go to court to get the right to claim, but it's very rare that people will do that. And the form that you have to sign basically declares, I know that there is no other family. So if the county finds other family, you can see there's a bit of a legal tussle that could develop. And so a lot of friends and chosen family were discouraged from claiming.
So what that means is that the person that the medical examiner asks to organize the funeral might be the wrong person for the job. It might be somebody who is legally tied to the decedent, but actually it doesn't really have a good relationship with the decedent. And other people who are available might not be asked to organize the funeral. So some of that is a mismatch between who is considered to be the legal next of kin and who is the person most likely to organize a funeral and take on the burden for that.
Yeah, we ran into that in the hospital too, with because we weren't allowed to do an autopsy unless we had a signed consent form from the legal next of kin. And there would always be circumstances where there would be a cousin that really was the best friend of the person or something, but she was married, even though they were estranged, she was legally married or had a kid, even if she didn't talk to the kid. And, you have to follow those rules of, they're pretty stringent with it with autopsy. I guess they are when it comes to the unclaimed bodies too. When the body, so I don't really know what happens. I send the body, 7 days after it would be in the hospital, and then it would go to the ME's office. And I know when I rotated at the ME's office, there were several boxes of cremated remains in the morgue just sitting there. Is there a timeline? I guess this varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but is there an average timeline where those cremated remains stay in the medical examiner's office? Like, do they just stay there forever, or is there a point where they get rid of them and do something with them?
So Los Angeles is interesting because there's one agency that's allowed to inter in that grave, that common grave or the Potter's Field, unclaimed cremains. And that is the Office of Decedent Affairs. So Los Angeles has three different county bureaucracies that are involved in death. And that would be the medical examiner coroners. They're going to handle the suspicious cases, the sudden deaths, right? The ones that you've talked about with Stefan. And then you also have the Office of Decedent Affairs. And so they're gathering and they're collecting bodies from more mundane deaths, hospital deaths, nursing homes, residences, where a doctor will sign a death certificate. And then you have the public administrator's office, which doesn't actually deal with any of the bodies, but does handle the estates and checking next of kin in many cases across the two agencies. So, right, so you have these three different agencies. But what would happen in the medical examiner's office is, or in funeral homes, you also have a lot of abandoned ashes in funeral homes. They'll be transferred. It'll all get transferred to the Office of Decedent Affairs. And then at the end of the third year of storing those cremains, the County of Los Angeles or the Office of Decedent Affairs will combine the cremains and inter them in a mass or common grave.
So what that really means is that there is like this little building next to the county crematorium that contains the cremains of about 5,000 people in little boxes, all stacked next to one another, because they keep them for 3 years. So there's year one, year two, year three, all about 1,500 to 2,000 of those boxes. So, and then the family has 3 years the time to retrieve the ashes, but not many are of them are going to do that. But the county tries to make it as easy as possible, or give the family as much time as possible to retrieve first the body and then the cremains.
That's interesting. So they're basically saying like, hey, we took care of all this. We paid for it. All you got to do is come pick it up.
Yeah, it's a really nominal fee.
Yeah.
And the fee can be waived because they really, you know, they don't want to put those bodies in a mass grave. But if they need to, they need to.
Do you know percentage-wise how many bodies, when they get to that point, or like remains, are actually getting picked up? Or they're, do people come and get them, or it's just like not really that common?
It's not that common. It's like between 10-15%. I mean, based on our records, you know, based on looking through the ledgers of the Office of Decedent Affairs, it's about 10-15%. But the overwhelming majority just gathers dust on the shelves.
It's really interesting because doing this for so, I mean, I was in a hospital that we had like 500 to 600 deaths a year, right? So I was constantly like every day dealing, releasing bodies to funeral homes. And it, usually in most cases, and this is what you're talking about, the sociology portion of it, when a person dies, the funeral home might call us right away before we even hear that the body died. The person might still be on the floor in the hospital, because that's what happens in families and people that are, when you have loved ones by your side and everything. It would be even very unusual to not hear anything within 24 hours. Like if we had a body in there for a day, we'd be like, all right, like what's this person still doing here, you know? And that actually happened with Marilyn Monroe. She was unclaimed for over 24 hours. And then finally, Joe DiMaggio, which was her ex, came in and said, all right, I'm going to take her and I'll pay for her to get a funeral. But like nobody's allowed to come to this funeral because they're responsible for her death. Every week on Mother Knows Death, we talk about all of these different stories that relate to posts that we have in the Gross Room, and I think you guys would really love it if you joined. Right now, you could join for only $5.99 a month, and you get to see multiple posts a week. We have thousands of posts, pictures, videos over the course of years. When did we start the Gross Room? In 2019, yeah, and you can see all the way back. And it's just really awesome. If you have an interest in any particular topic, you could search by the title. Like I was just telling you about the guy that got impaled with the garden flag, and that is called Damage by Decoration. But you also could just search, like today I didn't remember what I called the post, so I just searched garden flag there and lawnmower. If you search lawnmower, all the lawnmower accidents will come up, so... It's really awesome, and we have a great group of people in the Gross Room, so only $5.99 a month.
Yeah, so visit thegrossroom.com for more info.
Did you, when you guys were doing this research, did you come across any like really crazy stories or things that shocked you to how this person got to this point in their life where they had nobody to come and claim them?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of stories that we encountered. So we do write about four people, right, in the book in depth, but we came across more than 600 cases in varying levels of depth as we were doing our research and really looking at them. And, you know, some of the stories are really tragic. People who, you know, there was one story of a woman I'll never forget, and she died in her car. I believe it was from a drug overdose. And but as you sort of start trying to uncover her story, right, a lot of what we're trying to do here is tell stories of people who would otherwise be forgotten. And as we started to learn about her life, we found out that, you know, when she was a young child, her mother had committed suicide in front of her.
God.
Her father had been in prison. And she had grown up in the foster system, never really kind of getting the stability, right, that a young child needs. She had a child herself, but she was divorced and that child was living with the father. At one point in her life, she actually changed her name to Pussycat, legally went to court and changed her name to Pussycat. And we talked to her ex-husband, and he cared for her. But, you know, given the strict laws around disposition, he didn't get involved. And so that one really always struck me as really tragic of, you know, sort of feeling like this was somebody who from the very beginning, you know, the things were not on her side. Then there were some sort of stories that just they shouldn't have been unclaimed if you think about it in a kind of logical sense. So I'm thinking about your question earlier around, you know, are there wealthy people who go unclaimed? And there was one man who had over $1 million in his bank account when he died. And he did have a will, but the county was hired by his brother, who wanted nothing to do with the disposition, to take care of the cremation. The brother got the check for over $1 million, but he didn't show up for the at-sea burial. So, you know, you sort of see a lot of different, and both of those cases just have always kind of stuck with me.
Yeah, it's really sad to hear that people are in, you look at this person that's an older adult that's dead and a life of drugs and all that. But then when you go and think about them as a child, because ultimately, like all people were always somebody's baby, right? And and just, it's so sad to hear that any child would have to go through something like that. And eventually all children grow up and then they're going to be a product of whatever they grew up around. It's just, it's terrible. On the other hand, like, have you ever heard any stories from people, even the family members talking about this people and saying that this person was actually a really terrible person and I could totally see why nobody wanted anything to do with them when they were dying?
Yeah, definitely. We heard lots of family members who told us, you know, of stories of abuse, abandonment, struggles, you know, for decades with a sibling, for example, that they hadn't gotten along in decades, you know, and looking at those coroner case records, there's little snippets of information that get recorded in the coroner files about, you know, explanations for why people choose not to claim. And often you do see, you know, stories of families that have been torn apart by drugs, or, you know, poverty puts a tremendous amount of strain on families, right? And we ask so much of families to sort of do it all in this country without a real social safety net. And so, yeah, there were some people who you could imagine maybe they'd always been difficult to get along with. And then there were other people where you could sort of see the way that over time their social relations became strained as a consequence of the struggles that they faced. And also just as people are getting older, their social circles are shrinking, right? And so we have one case that we write about in the book, you know, David, where he had literally the sort of radius in which he lived his life just got smaller and smaller over time, to the point that, you know, he went from having a car to then having a bicycle to then just walking and then struggling to kind of walk around his apartment complex. So that was also a way I think about it. It's just sort of like the way that we in America have allowed people to grow older alone.
Yeah, it's interesting because I remember my one grandmom died when she was like 99. She was a couple months short of her 100th birthday. And I remember talking to her in the last couple of years of her life and her saying that everybody that she knew is dead. All her siblings, even some of her children's husbands were all dead. And I mean, luckily for her, she had kids. So, you know, she had a strong support system. But I imagine that it happens sometimes that people that choose not to have children or their children have passed, that could become a real issue when even everyone that you've always hung around and friends-wise are gone as well.
Yeah, or the kids care. I mean, some kids don't care anymore. We see cases of people who basically have been forgotten in a nursing home. You know, they haven't seen visitors in years. And so, and when they die, there's like, you know, sociologists have this notion of the social debt, where you're basically being treated as if you're dead while you're still alive. but people are talking about you in the past tense. And so you can see that in some of those situations where people are warehoused away and they're already written out of the interactions and the society, even though they're still biologically alive.
Do you feel as if unclaimed bodies are increasing every year?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And can you attribute that to, like, is it because people are just being pumped full of drugs and kept alive longer, or is it you think, a sociological thing?
We think it's more due to widespread estrangement and social isolation. So they're almost like the canaries in the coal mine, the unclaimed. It takes a lot to get to the state where your relatives are, unwilling to bury you. But there's a lot of factors that come together that foster social isolation. So it's sort of like an extreme indicator of, a whole bunch of processes and a whole bunch of policies, a lack of a social safety net, widespread estrangement, breakdowns of families, a whole bunch of these factors coming together, and that leads to people going unclaimed. And of course, some people outlive all their relatives, but you always find a relative. It doesn't mean that if you're to be old, doesn't mean that you should be alone and isolated. The medical examiners or a genealogist will always find a relative. If there is a big estate, if there's a lot of money, hair hunters will come in and they will go comb through all the records until they come up with an entire family tree. So there always are relatives. The question is, are these relatives always going to care?
Have you ever interviewed a family that expressed regret for not making things right before the person died and not claiming their body and doing the right thing for them, especially if it was like a sibling or a parent or something like that?
Nothing specific is coming to mind that we directly spoke with family members. I will say that the people who work for the county, so there's a wonderful human being, Mr. Craig Garnett, that works at the county crematorium in Los Angeles, and he's been there for decades. And he'll tell you stories, the family members who come by and they find out decades later that they had a loved one or a family member who was cremated and buried at this county cemetery. And so in those cases, you can imagine, maybe they found out just so much later than they would have been had an opportunity to claim. And so I think that there's, Stefan, what did Craig call it? It was bittersweet. Yeah, so it was bittersweet that he saw with the families, because on one hand, they've lost this opportunity to do a funeral or to claim their family member, but they also get closure. And so they get an opportunity to sort of close the story and understand where their loved one ended up.
So this is more in situations where relatives don't know what happened to their loved one. Being LA, we have lots of people coming in to try to break through in the movie industry or the music industry. And then they might lose track with their home communities or their migrants. And so some people go on a search to fill out the family tree. What happened to Uncle Tony? And then they find out that a person is buried in the crematorium. In Boyle Heights, in the Potter's Field. And so those people feel a sense of bittersweetness and the sense that they finally find out what's about the relative that they've been wondering for a long time. And at the same time, what they find is that the person is dead and buried in a mass grave.
I was looking up some stuff yesterday and I came across a website. I don't know if Philadelphia has one, because that's the medical examiner I interned at. I don't know if they have a specific website for this, but it was another county close to Philadelphia. They actually have all of their unclaimed people listed on the website, and you could contact them about it, which I thought was pretty cool, because you don't have to make any weird calls. You could just look on your own. But I know I know that that is an issue because people don't realize that a person has died. I think we did just talk about a story a couple months ago that might have happened in LA, but somewhere in California where there, like, a mom lost her son, and there was something about the being unidentified or and unclaimed because of, you know, the family's not nearby. They weren't able to get a hold of anybody, and this kid was there and they didn't know that he was dead. And, you know, that happens, especially with kids that are on drugs, or teenagers or young adults that are on drugs and kind of lose connection with their family. So are you guys supportive of these websites that try to connect family members with their deceased loved ones?
Yeah, absolutely. So I should say, you know, in most cases, the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office was able to locate next of kin. There are situations in which they're not. Or they've located a next of kin who's a legal next of kin, but maybe then they stop, right? Because then they've fulfilled their due diligence. They're not going to go to the entire family tree and notify everybody. So if within a family, you have estrangement among different sectors of the family and one person knows but hasn't told the other person, that might also be a situation, right, where decades later or years later, somebody has found out that they lost a family member. But in terms of, you know, we absolutely think there needs to be more public attention, obviously, to this topic, but also counties and local government officials making the names publicly available so that people can, you know, before somebody is going to be cremated or interred, so that family members can track them down to try to, you know, step in to get some sense of understanding or closure in many cases. So for years, Los Angeles did not make the names of the unclaimed publicly available. And there was a reporter at the Los Angeles Times, John Slois, who's now in representing the News Guild Union. And he had really gone to a ton of effort to get access to those handwritten registers that list every single person in Los Angeles County who's been cremated or buried since 1896. He focused on 1 year. And he took photos of these registers on his iPhone and then in his free time digitized the names. And that was the first time that these names had been made public. He put them on the Los Angeles Times website. That was the first time. And through that kind of pressure of people, journalists, researchers like ourselves, there's been some greater pressure on the county. And so now they do put names. But the last I checked, it's only up to 2020. So they haven't been putting names from the last few years.
Yeah. And that's another thing is I was reading this article from the Philadelphia Inquirer about last year in the Medical Examiner's Office of Philadelphia. They were really looking at, because there's so many people that are considered to be unidentified. And that's the problem, because they lack resources, especially after the pandemic and everything like that. They're just like behind. So these people they're unidentified, but then they're also unclaimed because they don't really know who they are. But maybe if they knew exactly who they were, they would be able to get somebody to actually claim them. But the ME's office, I always say this, it's like this one, it's the same with autopsy in the hospital too. Like the people are dead, they're not paying health insurance. They don't care. It's like once you die, they don't care to give money anymore. So you're working on like a really small lack of resources to do all of this stuff.
Yeah, we have a chapter in the book called The Dead Don't Vote.
Exactly, right?
Which gets at this notion. And so that's why, you know, the dead need the living, right? The unclaimed need us to advocate on their behalf, right? So putting pressure on local government officials, being willing to, you know, put more resources towards these departments that are overstretched and their staff are often burnt out for all the reasons we talked about earlier in terms of the difficulty of the work. Now, Los Angeles County over the last several years has actually done a fantastic job of reducing the number of unidentified. So when we talk about, you know, 1,600 people going unclaimed and being interred in that common grave in Boyle Heights, maybe a dozen or less will be unidentified in any given year. Now that's really low. That's awesome. Yeah, and you know, I will admit this because what I knew about forensics was probably limited to television until I got into this project. So I'm speaking for myself, not my brilliant co-author. But I really thought, oh, they'll do DNA on everybody. Yeah, right. And no, they don't.
Yeah.
They don't, right? And so primarily identifications are made through databases and just matching pictures, matching driver's license to the database. And so, you know, there are people who live off the grid who, you know, make a tremendous effort to not be found, to not be discovered. So that also could make it a little trickier to be identified in certain places that wouldn't have the same kind of full-time staff or resources the way that Los Angeles does.
Yeah, that's great. Because I think last year in Philadelphia alone, there was 15 that were unidentified. And it's interesting because, I mean, LA County is so much bigger than Philadelphia. So I mean, it's great that you guys have the resources to do that. I know that you talked about this annual memorial to commemorate the dead in LA County. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I'm going to let Stefan talk.
So this is one of the very moving, most moving ceremonies I've actually ever attended in my life. So, what happens is that the county gathers these cremains from 3 years ago, and at some point, you know, the shells are full and they need to do something with it. And so they put them in a common grave, which they create a couple of days before the ceremony. And from a county's perspective, this could be enough. You know, this could be the end of the story. But they actually decide to add some dignity to it by organizing this interfaith ceremony run by the chaplain of one of the local hospitals. And he brings in a whole bunch of religious leaders of different faiths, including, if he can find them, a Native American healer. And they, based on their tradition, welcome the dead and send them over to the afterlife. And the event has been open to the public, although it was closed down during COVID, but they're trying to open it up again. And I hope based on our book, they will get much more interest in this event as well. And so basically you're standing shoulder to shoulder with all these Angelinos that you don't know anything about. You're strangers to one another. And the people being buried are strangers too, because you know we don't know their stories. And it's such a moving event to show up and take on the mourning of these people who have been forgotten by their relatives. And for just half an hour that the ceremony lasts, we become all together. We become like a surrogate family for these people being buried. So it's deeply touching.
Yeah, that really is nice because like you're saying, they don't really have to do that.
No.
And it's like very respectful. I think that's really awesome. So what's next for you guys? Like your book comes out today. I know that it's like going to be a crazy couple weeks. And then has this changed your trajectory of your life in any way about what you want to do next?
Well, that depends on how many people buy the book today and in the coming weeks. It could, you know, The thing they never tell you about writing a book is that you're going to have to promote it. So we have to, you know, get the word out. And as we opened with, just kind of get people thinking about this topic. And I do just want to interject for just a second and say it is a sad topic. It is a sad book. But there are these moments of hope. There is at the end, as Stefan was describing the ceremony, we describe other ceremonies around other subpopulations of the unclaimed. There is, we think, a bit of a roadmap for thinking about repairing some aspects of the social fabric. So building off that, kind of thinking about what we can do. I would love my next project to be something that would be maybe a little bit more lighthearted. But alas, what comes out of this story for me that still remains unanswered is understanding why so many families are becoming estranged. I didn't expect to be studying family estrangement when I started studying unclaimed bodies. And so that's where my next research project will be going.
That's awesome. Cause I think it's really important because I do see an increase of that. And it's everything, you know, especially when you are dealing with the very end of life to see what happened. That's what it's about. And I think it's really awesome that you're doing that. And how about you, Stefan? This is your second book about dead bodies now. I'm starting to think you want to come over to our side and do this for a living.
I think I'm already at your side because I'm teaching a class on dead, dying, and the afterlife to UCLA undergraduate students. Yes. But I think, you know, you cannot do research on a topic like this and not take stock of your own life. You know, this is kind of a wake-up call. I mean, you study these people who get more and more socially isolated. They're gathering stuff, and then when they die, it just gets liquidated. It's a call to what really matters in your own life. And I think, just speaking for myself, it's sort of like a moment of taking stock and decide, okay, I'm here in life. I probably have X amount of time left. What am I going to do with this? It's a conversation starter for how do we want to be as a community, as a society? How much do we want to invest in social relationships? But it's also sort of like an individual wake-up call. Where do we want to go? Where do I want to go next? And what do I want to accomplish? Where do I want to make my mark? You cannot just live with the illusion of immortality. When you see this book, nobody grows up thinking, when I die, I want to go unclaimed. I want nobody to care that I died. No, something happens in life that you get to a point where you end up alone, abundant at death. And what can we do in our lives to avoid that? I think that's one of these questions that this book pulls out.
Yeah, I was actually thinking that too. Like, is it how to make you kind of a better person, like how to not end up unclaimed? When you read all these stories, I'm sure there's some overlapping common factors that happen in each of the stories that a lot of people might relate to, that they could see they're kind of going down that road with their family or something and maybe can repair it before it's too late. Yep. Well, thanks so much for being here today, guys. It's awesome. And everybody, I want everybody to go get your book today. It's on sale. Where could they get it? Everywhere, Amazon, or just everywhere where you have books? Preferred. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
The preferred retailer.
Okay, awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much. It was a great conversation. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Mother Knows Death. As a reminder, my training is as a pathologist assistant. I have a master's level education and specialize in anatomy and pathology education. I am not a doctor, and I have not diagnosed or treated anyone, dead or alive, without the assistance of a licensed medical doctor. This show, my website, and social media accounts are designed to educate and inform people based on my experience working in pathology, so they can make healthier decisions regarding their life and well-being. Always remember that science is changing every day, and the opinions expressed in this episode are based on my knowledge of those subjects at the time of publication. If you are having a medical problem, have a medical question, or are having a medical emergency, please contact your physician or visit an urgent care center, emergency room, or hospital. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Mother Knows Death on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or anywhere you get podcasts. Thanks.